Now we're starting five chapters that have to do with DNA. And so this is going to take us not only through the rest of this unit, but actually one chapter beyond the next test. We'll still be talking about DNA. And everyone nowadays is familiar with DNA. You know it as an informational molecule. It's probably the almost certainly the most famous molecule, at least within biology. We know a lot about it nowadays, but that hasn't always been true. Anyway, before we get into a little bit of the history about DNA, let's say something that I've said in here before and that I've said in several other courses that I teach. DNA has really two major functions, right? What are those functions? Not transcription and translation, no. Transcription and replication. Translation does not involve DNA. All right. Well, this first slide shows you these two major functions of DNA. And it also shows you how they really are different in terms of what they're doing. Replication, meaning making an exact copy of that DNA so that there are now two copies, is really not something the cell is doing for itself, right? Replication is about ensuring that that information that the DNA is carried gets carried on to the next generation of cells. So cells come from pre-existing cells. New cells are created by cells that already exist. And this happens by splitting into two, right? So a cell will split into two new cells. Therefore, if each of those two new cells is going to survive, it needs a full set of DNA molecules. Therefore, the parent cell needs to make two copies out of its one in order to let those two cells exist. So replication, one of the two major jobs of DNA, is really not for that cell. It's for the next generation of cells. Whereas the other major function, which is transcription, is all about the lifetime of that cell. Now, we often say that DNA gives us, or any organism, its traits, right? But that's only indirectly true. It's not directly true. Your actual traits, you know, the way you smell, the way you taste, the way you look, the way you think, those are all due to the particular types of proteins that you as an organism happen to be able to make, of the effectively infinite number of proteins that could be made. It's proteins that directly give you your traits. But even though there are effectively infinite number of different proteins that could be made, your cell never makes most of them because it has to know how to make a protein. And that's what DNA is all about in terms of the lifetime of that cell. That's what transcription is for, at least in most cases. Transcription really just refers to using the information that's in DNA, whereas replication is not, right? Replication passes on an informational molecule, but it's not really using that information. Transcription uses the information in the form of the sequence of nucleotides that make up that DNA. That's where the information is contained, the fact that it is a particular sequence. Well, transcription occurs at subsequences of an overall DNA molecule. And what are those subsequences called? In other words, what gets transcribed? I'm not hearing it. Genes, thanks. Yeah, a gene is what gets transcribed. A gene itself is a sequence of DNA nucleotides, but it's only a subset of the overall length, which is much, much longer than the gene itself. A whole molecule, in other words, contains many genes. But a gene is what gets transcribed individually, one gene at a time. And transcription uses that sequence of DNA nucleotides in that gene to produce what in all cases? No, I successfully trapped you. It's not true that every gene gets transcribed into messenger RNA. only certain genes. Most genes, yes. But there are two major categories of genes. There are what we call protein-coding genes and non-protein-coding genes. Protein-coding genes obviously code for proteins, right? Indirectly, though, not directly. No gene directly codes for a protein. A protein-coding gene, when it gets transcribed, the product of that transcription is, as you said, messenger RNA. Messenger RNA is not the final goal. Messenger RNA is just another nucleic acid that is now carrying information so that it can be translated into a polypeptide. So that's where the protein gets created in the second step, right? Translation, which does not involve DNA. DNA, in other words, hands off the information to messenger RNA, which then carries the information to a ribosome where translation occurs and the polypeptide is assembled one amino acid at a time according to the sequence in the messenger RNA. That's what happens for most genes, and those genes indirectly give you your traits because they indirectly allow for the creation of the actual proteins that your cells are able to make. But there are other genes, the non-protein coding genes, and when they get transcribed, what is produced? Any idea? What'd you say? No? Other kinds of RNA. Messenger RNA is just one type of RNA, right? There's many kinds of RNA. Transfer RNA, ribosomal RNA, small interfering RNA, small nuclear RNA, right? There's all kinds of different RNA molecules. Well, these things don't just pop into existence, just like proteins don't just pop into existence. A specific RNA molecule is a polymer. The cell has to know how to build that. So there needs to be a code for how to build all the different kinds of RNA, not just messenger RNA. It's just that in the case of the other RNAs, that RNA is, in a sense, the goal. Whereas in messenger RNA, it's not quite the goal yet. The messenger RNA then goes on to instruct the production of the protein itself. So, you know, you wouldn't have a ribosome, for instance, which you need to make a protein, if you didn't know how to make that ribosomal RNA. Our RNA has genes that tell the cell how to build that rRNA. So those are what the non-protein coding genes do. Anyway, getting back to where I trapped you, you can say that in all cases, transcription leads to the production of an RNA molecule of some sort. That RNA molecule, in the case of protein coding genes, is going to be messenger RNA. In the case of non-protein coding genes, it's going to be some other kind of RNA. So when we look into the right side here and we see transcription occurring first and then translation, this is specifically a protein coding gene, which, as I say, are most of your genes. We're looking at this as it happens in a eukaryote. Of course, the same is true for prokaryotes as well. They have replication of their DNA for the same reason. They have transcription and translation of their DNA, or transcription of their DNA and translation of their messenger RNA for the same reason as well. The fundamental difference, of course, is what makes them different to begin with, the presence of membrane-bounded organelles. So in a eukaryotic cell where there is a true nucleus, there is therefore a nuclear envelope. Well, this compartmentalizes and separates the two processes of protein synthesis. The two parts of protein synthesis are transcription and translation. In a eukaryotic cell, transcription occurs in the nucleus, because that's where the chromosomes are, which includes the DNA. Translation, though, occurs where the ribosomes are, which are out in the cytoplasm. And so you can see the arrow going through one of the nuclear pores in a eukaryotic cell. That's because for translation to occur, the messenger RNA needs to be exported out of the nucleus so that it can join up with the ribosome. This is a step that's not required in a prokaryote, right? Which is why they can get their proteins produced a lot faster. We'll talk more about that in a different chapter. Let's go on to two. Now, for the first half of the 1900s, roughly, comparatively few biologists believed that DNA was the genetic material, even though they knew of the existence of DNA. Now, if you go back even farther in time, actually further. Anyway, back in the days of Mendel, he figured a lot out about genetics, as you know, without even realizing that DNA exists. He had no idea what DNA was. It was discovered a little bit after his experiments. So, but there was plenty of time in which we knew that DNA existed, and a lot of people just didn't believe that it was the genetic material. Now, this makes sense for a couple reasons, one of which is, if you know that there are these polymers in the cell, and for various reasons they kind of discounted polysaccharides as being a candidate for the genetic material, and so that left proteins and nucleic acids. And if you compare the proteins and nucleic acids as polymers, proteins have greater complexity, right? Because, well, why is that? Why do they have greater complexity? You have more choices. And by that, I assume you mean that there are 20 choices of beads. If you think of these things as making necklaces out of beads, you have 20 different kinds of beads to choose from, the 20 biological amino acids, right? If you're going to build it. For every single bead, you have 20 choices. And then you can make it as long as you want. So, you know, there's 20 squared possibilities just for two amino acids, which is not even a protein yet. It's not long enough, right? So it's 20 times 20 times 20 times 20 for however many amino acids long it is. That's how many different possibilities there are. That's why I say it's effectively infinite number of proteins that could be made. Whereas there's only four choices in DNA, right? An adenine, a guanine, a cytosine, or a thymine-based nucleotide are your four choices. That runs into big numbers as well, but just not nearly as big as when you're multiplying 20 together a lot of times. So the rationale was, since proteins have such greater complexity possible, it stands to reason that something as complex as governing all of our traits must rest on something that itself is a very complex molecule. So a lot of biologists didn't believe that DNA was doing that, even though we didn't have any other job for DNA. We knew it was there, one of the four major biological macromolecules, just had no idea what it was doing, and most people just didn't believe that it was the genetic material. Thought it was protein. Well, slide two shows you the results of actually a couple major experiments. Back in the 20s, there was the so-called Griffith experiment, who demonstrated for the first time what we now recognize as bacterial transformation, a way for bacteria to take up DNA and therefore change their actual genome. This was back before we knew that DNA was the genetic material. What he did was inject mice with two different strains of the same bacterium, but there was a so-called S strain and an R strain. They're called that smooth and rough because if you let them form colonies on a plate, the S strain, because it forms a polysaccharide outside itself, makes a smooth-looking colony. And it's that polysaccharide that allows that version of the bacterium to elude the immunity of the mouse. It makes it into the mouse safely, basically, without being killed, and therefore causes pneumonia in the mouse, which is fatal. So the S version is the dangerous one. The R one can't produce that polysaccharide, and therefore the colonies look different. Well, that one gets killed by the immune system of the mouse, so it's not the harmful version. Well, what Griffith did originally was really shown in A here. If he injected mice with living S strain, the dangerous one, not surprisingly, they died. If he injected them with living R ones, not surprisingly, they lived because that's the one that's not dangerous. If he heat killed the S bacteria before he injected them, not surprisingly again, the mice lived because dead bacteria don't cause harm to you. The surprising one was when he heat killed S and then mixed the dead S with living R and then injected that mixture into the mice. They died. Even though there weren't any living S bacteria, there weren't any living dangerous ones. So this was the first demonstration of bacterial transformation. What had happened is that the R bacteria transformed into S bacteria. And we know nowadays that they did that by taking up bits of DNA from the dead S bacteria. That's what transformation is. So he's the one that actually named this transformation. Well, this, like I said, was in the 20s. This didn't really demonstrate that DNA was the genetic material, but it demonstrated that there definitely is a genetic material of some sort. In other words, it gave proof that genetics works because of a particle of some sort. All right? Later on in the 30s, we have what's a refinement of Griffith's original experiment, and this refinement is credited to McCarty, McLeod, and or Avery, McCarty, and McLeod and McCarty are what is usually the order of the three names. Anyway, crediting the people is not important as what's going on here. What they did was the Griffith experiment that you see above, but then they played around with it a little more. If they did this mixture of heat-killed S and living R, and then didn't mess with it at all, just like Griffith did originally, the mice died, of course. If they treated it with things that destroyed the lipids and polysaccharides before they injected it, then the mice died, which makes sense because we know DNA is the thing causing it, right? And lipids and polysaccharides are not. But they didn't know that. This therefore ruled out lipids and polysaccharides. They did it and then added proteases. Proteases are enzymes that destroy proteins. Once again, they died. So this ruled out proteins, which is what people believed at the time was the genetic substance. On the other hand, if they added RNAs, if they added DNAs, it lived. If they added RNAs, it didn't live. So they ruled out everything except DNA. This was pretty convincing evidence. But even people still weren't convinced. It took another decade and a half or so before they were, and another important experiment, which is in slide 3. Do we stop at 20 after? Okay. So this was in the 50s, and this is the so-called Hershey-Chase experiment. And this is the one that really brought most people around to believing that DNA was the genetic material. What they did was, by the time this was occurring, people had ruled out lipids, polysaccharides as being genetic material. So it was really a contest between proteins and DNA. And like I said, the reasons I gave before was why people still clung on to the belief that it was proteins, because they're more complex. So this was a well-designed experiment because what they decided to use was a bacteriophage, which is a virus that invades bacteria. And this is a great choice for something to use to settle this argument because the bacteriophage is made of nothing but protein and DNA. So it doesn't have anything else in it that could be causing the effect. It's one or the other. And so a bacteriophage is really just a DNA molecule wrapped in a protein coat that we call the capsule. And when they connect to the surface of a bacterium, they inject what we now know as the DNA into the cell, and that is what causes the changes in the bacterium. what ends up being the case. Well, I'll get into that later. Anyway, in this Hershey-Chase experiment, they basically wanted to say, is it the answer to the question, is it the protein or is it the DNA that gets injected and therefore is the genetic material? So another part of the good design of this experiment is that they recognize that most proteins have at least a little bit of sulfur in them, because of there's two amino acids that have sulfur in their R group. So not every amino acid has sulfur, but when you talk about an entire protein, chances are there's going to be some sulfur in there. Whereas nucleic acids do not have sulfur. And on the other hand, nucleic acids, every nucleotide of a nucleic acid has phosphorus in it because of the phosphate group, right? Whereas you don't have phosphate in proteins, so, or at least not much. So what they did was use radio labeling. They used radioactive isotopes of these two elements, sulfur and phosphorus, to individually, separately label the two different macromolecules in the virus. They labeled the protein with sulfur, a radioactive isotope of sulfur, that's what S35 is. They labeled the nucleic acid, the DNA of the virus, with radioactive phosphorus. And they did that because the radioactivity allowed them to keep track of where these elements were going. They then allowed they did this in two separate batches, so at top and bottom, red and blue. So they allowed they mixed the labeled viri with the bacteria and let them infect them. They then used just an ordinary bar blender, which was the perfect device for this because it stirred it vigorously enough that after the injection of the material by the virus into the bacterium, the empty shell that was left outside would pop off. But it wasn't such a vigorous stirring that it would kill the bacteria. The cells were still intact. All right, so it just basically separated the leftover shells from the injected bacteria. And then they put it into a centrifuge so that the cells would go to the bottom and the empty shells would go to the top, the lighter stuff. And they just looked at the radioactivity. Well, when they did it with the stuff that was labeled with the bacterium, the protein was labeled with sulfur, they noticed that almost all the radioactivity was in the supernatant, which is where the empty shells went. Right? That alone is pretty good evidence that protein is not the genetic material. But on the dual experiment, when they labeled the DNA instead and looked for the radioactivity, it was almost entirely in the pellet, meaning that it was injected into the cell. So that was pretty definitive indication that the genetic material is indeed DNA. Now, there still were some lingerers on who said, okay, this demonstrates that DNA is the genetic material in a virus, but in something as complicated as a human, it must be still protein. Well, eventually they all came around, and we know, of course, today that DNA is the genetic material. So we'll start on 4 next time. Sorry about the delay.